Rolling Stone.
Wanna see our pictures on the cover.
Stone.
Wanna buy 5 copies for our mother.
Yeah.
Wanna see my smiling face on the cover of the Rolling Stone.
This is Dan Klingler, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. We're continuing today with Rolling Stone's special collector's edition on Paul McCartney. 50 years of classic interviews, Beatles memories, and rare photographs. The article that we'll be featuring today is You Can't Get It All Right All the Time. This is by Kurt Loder from a September 11, 1986 Rolling Stone. By the mid-80s, Paul had a head full of gray and a string of so-so albums behind him. Not that it was anything to get hung about. It's Monday in London, 2 days before the royal wedding, and Soho Square is filled with flowers, sunshine, and fresh-faced young tourists. Some loll on the grass, sharing joints. Others peer up expectantly at the etched glass windows of an Art Deco-style townhouse across the street, where, in an airy third-floor office, Paul McCartney presides over the bustling affairs of MPL Communications, the company that manages the professional projects of the singer and his wife, Linda. McCartney is in from his country home in Sussex, where he has a brand new state-of-the-art recording studio, to promote his latest LP, Pressed to Play. The years are beginning to tell. His hair is mostly gray these days, but he's as buoyant as ever, bubbling with enthusiasm. After 8 years of largely lackadaisical releases on Columbia, he is back with Capitol, the Beatles' old label, and he seems serious about rehabilitating his somewhat tattered artistic reputation. Pressed to Play features some good songs and a tough new pop sound, courtesy of Hugh Padgham, who co-produced it. Linda McCartney's background vocals are the only aural remnant of Wings. Pouring tea from a china pot, McCartney talks up his new tunes. One song, however absurd, is a stream-of-consciousness stew of non-sequiturs lifted from the works of such poets as W.H. Auden, and his ambitious plans for the future. But he cannot ignore his celebrated past and the persistent tug of its emotional undertow. Will he ever again be seen in as sweet a light as that which illuminated the Beatles 20 years ago? The subject seems open for discussion. Pauly passes the cream. On your new album, there's an almost punkish song called Angry. That's not an attitude usually associated with Paul McCartney. What are you angry about? Paul. Well, the same things a lot of us are angry about. Traffic jams, stuff like that. Paul. Well, there's that, the day-to-day piss-offs. But I was thinking more about British trade unions withdrawing coal when there's old ladies dying, and we just go, yeah, well, the union's got a right. And Britain's attitude toward apartheid at the moment, it's so insane. Couldn't they just wise up? But there's Maggie saying, we don't need to do sanctions. Well, everybody else, all the civil rights groups, are saying, but you do. A London tabloid, The Sun, recently questioned whether you were racist after hearing bootleg Beatles outtakes from the Let It Be sessions that feature you referring to Pakistanis, unflatteringly it seems, in a rendition of Get Back. Paul. Sensational journalism. The Sun is not a highly reputable newspaper. There were a couple of verses to Get Back which were not racist at all. They were anti-racist. There were stories in the newspapers then about Pakistanis crowding out flats, living 16 to a room or whatever. So in one of the verses of Get Back, one of the outtakes has something about too many Pakistanis living in a council flat. That's the line. Which to me was talking out against overcrowding for Pakistanis. I'll tell you, if there was any group that was not racist, it was the Beatles. I mean, all our favorite people were always black. We were kind of the first people to open international eyes, in a way, to Motown. Whenever we came to the States, they'd say, who's your favorite artist? And we'd say, well, they're mainly black and American. Motown, man. It's all there. You've got it all. You've actively supported causes you believe in, such as Live Aid. Are you troubled by reports that the money Live Aid raised for Ethiopia ultimately benefits that country's military regime and not the starving people? Paul. Well, before Live Aid, there was going to be another concert of that sort. David Astor, who was quite big in Amnesty at the time, told me that his son was in Eritrea at the moment and that there was very worrying news coming out. He said, if you do charity, it's going to go straight to the military. They say, thank you very much for helping our country. We're not buying food for our people. We're spending our money on guns. So, at the time of Live Aid, I did a bit of work on that and checked it out. Me, Astor, Pete Townsend, a few other people. And we decided that Bob Geldof had enough good people on the case. We wanted to do something, even if there was some risk. I mean, we were seeing people on television just dying in front of the camera. So I was glad to have done Live Aid. Someone's always going to bitch. When I did Ebony and Ivory with Stevie Wonder, a perfectly harmless attempt at pinpointing the need for racial harmony, some people said, it's just pap. Well, says you know. Like there's a great black sax player, Ernie Watts. I think he's got a white wife. And he came up to me at a session and said, oh man, thanks for that song. And that made it all worthwhile, you know. Just if one person's situation was alleviated to the tiniest degree. I don't care what all the critics say. Ernie Watts plays a hell of a lot better than any critic I ever heard. Is there any merit to the frequent charge that your post-Beatles music has gotten too soft? Paul. Yeah, I'm sure it's true. You can't get it right all the time. If there's been a fault with my stuff, I think that some of it was unfinished. So, yeah, I might have been a bit soft, and some of it might have been a bit unfinished. And sometimes a critic will say, that's really lousy. And I'll agree. He's right, it's not very good, that one. There are quite a few tracks that I just don't like now, like Bip Bop off Wildlife. Oh, God, I can't listen to it. It just goes nowhere. But occasionally a good one comes along, and occasionally there's a little wave on the little mill pond, and that makes it all worthwhile. Critics may be pleased by the harder pop sound of Press to Play. Some of the tracks have an almost experimental tilt to them. Paul. The funny thing is, there was a time when I was the avant-garde one in the Beatles, around the time of Sgt. Pepper, because that was largely my influence. I was trying to get everyone in the group to be farther out. John was living out in Weybridge with his wife and child, and I was being the bachelor in London, going to the theater, checking out the International Times, Allen Ginsberg. I used to make 8mm home movies and show them one frame at a time, flick, 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 which made them last about an hour, when they only should have been 10 minutes, you know. I remember showing them to Michelangelo Antonioni. I think he was in town filming Blow Up, and Keith Richards. We had some nice evenings, quite stoned evenings, I must admit, just watching these movies. I still have them. And I was into Stockhausen, and I used to make a lot of home tape loops and just send them to friends for, like, a buzz. I remember saying to John once, I'm going to do an album of this and call it Paul McCartney Goes Too Far. And he said, yeah, you got to do it, man. So I was the one who introduced John originally to a lot of that stuff. In fact, not many people know this, but Yoko came to my house before she met John. There was a charity thing. It was rather avant-garde, something to do with John Cage or something, and she wanted lyrics, manuscripts. I hate to tell you, but I didn't want to give her any of my lyrics, selfish or whatever. So I said, but there's a friend of mine who might want to help, my mate, John. So you were the catalyst for John and Yoko's relationship? Paul. Well, I don't know that, but I kind of put her on to John, and then they really hit it off. It was like a wildfire, you know? John was certainly in love. A little insecurely in love, because he warned me off Yoko, sort of said, look, no, because he knew I was a bit of a ladies' man. I like the girls, no doubt about that. And I said, yeah, okay. I mean, I wasn't about to anyway, but he didn't know that. You became involved with Linda Eastman instead. Has it been difficult to sustain such a controversial union? Paul, well, we've been up, we've been down, we've been in love, we've been out of love. We've been every which way, you know. It's certainly not been as idyllic as it looks on the surface. It's a real marriage, believe me, as real as any other marriage. The bottom line is that we love each other, and what's more, we like each other. It sounds corny, but what else can I say? Thinking about you and Linda and John and Yoko inevitably recalls the end of the Beatles. After all this time, the cause of the group's breakup still seems murky. What really happened? Paul. The actual story in my mind is that it was all getting a bit sticky during the White Album. And Let It Be was very sticky. George left the group then, and so did Ringo. But we managed to patch that back up. The dates are all purple haze to me, but at some point we had a meeting at the Apple office, and it was like, look, something's wrong, and we've got to sort it out. I had my suggestion. I said, what I think we ought to do is get back as a band, get back as the little unit we always were. I think we ought to hit small clubs and do a little tour. I just wanted to learn to be a band together again, because we'd become a business group. We'd become businessmen. And John looked me in the eye and he said, I think you're daft. In fact, I wasn't going to tell you, but I'm leaving the group. To my recollection, those were his exact words, and our jaws dropped. And then he went on to explain that it was rather a good feeling to get it off his chest, a bit like when he told his wife about a divorce. At first, we agreed not to announce it, but after 3 or 4 months, I felt guilty about people saying, how's the group going? When we sort of knew it was probably split up. So I did a kind of dumb move, and when I look back on it, it looks very hard and cold. I was releasing McCartney, and I didn't really want to do much press, so I told a guy from the office to do me a list of questions, and I'll write the answers, and we'll print it up and just stick it in with the press copies of the album. It ended up being like me announcing that the Beatles had broken up. John got quite mad. This is one of the things he said really hurt him. I don't think it was such a bad thing to announce to the world after 4 months that we'd broken up. I think maybe the manner of doing it I regret now. I wish I'd been a little kinder or with the others' approval. But I felt it was the time. Weren't the others also upset that your album McCartney was released a month before Let It Be? Paul. Yeah, I think John thought I was using this press release for publicity, as I suppose in a way I was. The good thing about it was that we all had to finally own up to the fact that we'd broken up 3 or 4 months before. We'd been ringing each other quite constantly, sort of saying, let's get it back together again. And I think me, George, and Ringo did want to save things. But I think John was, at that point, too heavily into his new life, which you can't blame him for. Did it sadden you to see Lennon drift into heroin addiction? Paul. Yeah, I really didn't like that. Unfortunately, he was drifting away from us at that point, so none of us actually knew. He never told us. We heard rumors, and we were very sad. But he'd embarked on a new course, which involved anything and everything, because John wanted to live his life to the full, as he saw. I remember we had dinner one night, and John was saying he was thinking of having this trepanning thing done, drilling a hole in the skull. The Romans or the Greeks or somebody used to do it. So that gave it a validity in John's mind, I think. And he said, would you be up for that? Do you fancy doing that? We could go and get it done. I said, why? He said, it relieves the pressure on your brain. I said, look, you go try it. And if it's great, you tell me, and maybe I'll do it. That was the kind of stuff that was floating around then. I just feel very lucky to have said no to those things. Because at the time, I felt bad about saying no. I thought, oh, here I go again. Look at me, unadventurous. I mean, I got such pressure when I wouldn't take acid for the first time. I got a lot of pressure there. Was it like the group sitting around all dropping acid in? Paul. Yeah. They were saying, what's wrong with him? Now looking back on it, I think, Jesus, I must have had some courage to actually resist that peer pressure. But at the time, I felt really goody-goody, you know. Hey, Mr. Clean, squeaky clean, you know? I was like, oh, come on, fellas, I'm not really squeaky clean, but you know, acid is going to do our heads in. But you eventually did try LSD. Paul. Yeah, finally. In actual fact, it was because John had done it by mistake. We turned up for a session at Abbey Road, and he thought he'd taken a pep pill, speed or whatever, to sort of wake him up for the evening, but it turned out to be acid. He had a little pill box, and he'd taken the wrong pill. This was around the time of Sergeant Pepper. Well, we didn't get a lot done that night. John came over and said, geez, I'm tripping. And we all went, okay, keep cool, lad. Now, is this a good place to be tripping? He said, no, not really. Okay, George Martin didn't know. We said, George, John's not feeling too well. So George took him up on the roof. We said, maybe that's not a good idea, George. I said, tell you what, I'll take him home. So I took him home, and that was my first trip that night, because I figured, you know, I can't leave the guy on his own. He was all, oh. Your apparent preference for marijuana has made headlines over the years. Do you still indulge? Paul, I don't talk about stuff like that no more. It's too crazy. Where I was lucky was with my avoidance of heroin. I said, no thanks, and avoided that scene. And I thank God that I did, because a lot of my friends didn't. And they went through some horror zones, you know. Some of them didn't come out of it. On a more trivial note, a new biography of you claims that you're actually right-handed. Paul, no, I'm quite definitely left-handed. When I first got a guitar, I couldn't understand what was wrong with it because I really couldn't get it together. I felt so unrhythmic, so white, you know. I just had no rhythm in my hands. Then I saw a picture of Slim Whitman, and he had his guitar the wrong way around. He was the first lefty I'd ever seen, and I said, hey, shit, that's it. Turn the guitar upside down. After that, my strumming hand got a little blacker again. Did you feel similarly reassured when Jimi Hendrix turned up on the London scene? Paul. Yeah, Jimi was brilliant. I knew him and loved him. The first time I saw him was down at a club. I think it was the Bag of Nails, and I was just completely blown away. He'd wind up a 100-watt Marshall and hit his guitar, and it'd go, be-ow-roo-roo-ow. Fantastic. Townsend and Eric Clapton were in the audience, and our jaws were just dropping. And he was a very sweet guy, very quietly spoken, very enthusiastic. The greatest compliment he paid me was when the Beatles did Sgt. Pepper. It was released on a Friday night, and on Sunday, Jimmy played a gig and opened with Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band. Oh, man, that was so good. I mean, it had been out only 2 days. I have very fond memories of Jimmy. I mean, Van Halen's great. I love Eddie Van Halen, but I still think Jimmy was the best. After John Lennon conquered his drug problem, did you finally patch up your relationship? Paul. We were submerged in business troubles at the time. At one point, to get some peace in the camp, I told my lawyers I wanted to give John an indemnity he had been seeking against a certain clause in one of the Apple contracts. I happened to be passing through New York, so I rang John up. But there was suspicion, even though I came bearing the olive branch. He said, what for? What do you really want? Finally, he had a great line for me. He said, you're all pizza and fairy tales. He'd become Americanized by then, so the best insult I could think of was to say, oh, fuck off, Kojak, and slam the phone down. Pizza and fairy tales. I almost made that an album title. But thank God at the very end, we suddenly realized that all we had to do was not mention Apple if we phoned each other. We could talk about the kids, talk about his cats, talk about writing songs. So then the last couple of calls we had were getting very nice. I remember once he said to me, do they play me against you like they play you against me? Because there were always people in the background pitting us against each other. And I said, yeah, they do. They sure do. That was a couple of months before he, it's still weird even to say, before he died. I still can't come to terms with that. I still don't believe it. It's like those dreams you have where he's still alive. Then you wake up and, oh. It was all so tragic, but I do feel thankful that the last few years of his life were very happy, from what I can gather. He was always a very warm guy, John. His bluff was all on the surface. He used to take his glasses down, those granny glasses, and say, "It's only me." They were like a wall, you know, a shield. Those are the moments I treasure. I suppose we hurt each other, but I keep looking at all the evidence of how I hurt him, and it doesn't seem quite as bad as I think he was making it. I read about this thing going on sale at Sotheby's, this Apple booklet with John's comments in the margins. It is so bitter. Like there's a caption that says, "Paul goes to Hollywood," and he's apparently written in the margin to cut Yoko and John out of the film. He thought we were trying to cut Yoko out of Let It Be. I suppose we were in some degree because she wasn't in the Beatles, and it was a Beatles film, and it wasn't absolutely necessary to have long footage of her. She certainly was in there. But they felt she should be in there even more. I bent over backward trying to see John's point of view, trying to not malign him. "You seem to have been cast as the heavy in the breakup." Paul. "It isn't pleasant. A lot of the accusations John made in public were slightly wild. I mean, maybe we should have taken to Yoko a little better. I often do feel not too clever about not taking to her, because we didn't get on too well. She was a very different person from anything we'd encountered. A lot of people still find her a little difficult to take. I figure, well, he loved her, so it's nothing to do with me. I should respect her through him. I felt that I tried to do that. But we were being so set against each other that his unreasonable bitterness was almost inevitable, I think. But the bottom line is we loved each other, and I'm glad to be getting back to some semblance of sanity with George and Ringo now. We can meet and hug and say we love each other, you know? Might the three of you ever record together again?" Paul. "I don't know. I'd like to, but it's a touchy affair. I think all of us, rather than get the world's press on our backs, would rather just play that aspect down for now. But I'd like to. George and I have talked once or twice about maybe just plonking a couple of acoustics together. So that whole scene is warming up a bit. So I see hope for the future in that direction. I don't want to rush it. I don't want to put anyone off. I'll play it by ear. Just let it happen. Meanwhile, I'm thinking of getting a band together. I know the Beatles used to say, 'We won't be rocking and rolling when we're 40. But I still love it. The Prince's Trust benefit just zonked me out, seeing Eric Clapton, Mark Knopfler, Brian Adams, Elton, Tina. There was such a buzz on stage. I think they were glad to see me sort of vaguely getting into it. I sang, 'I saw her standing there,' and 'Long Tall Sally,' too, in the original key. It really felt great. I could do that every night. So I'd like to get a band. I don't know if I'll call it Wings. Maybe some new incarnation. Whatever may happen, will you be leaving the gray in your hair? It looks very distinguished." Paul. "Yeah, I'm leaving that. When you're past 40, the game is up, you know. My wife actually likes it. Ringo told me off about it, though. He reckoned I ought to color it. I think he's kind of gauging himself by how old I look, like I make him feel old if I look a bit old. But this is life. We're all getting older every second. My main thing is just to try and enjoy it. And I'm very surprised to find that, more often than not, I really do." Our next article is entitled Back on Top. This is by Anthony DeCurtis, and it is excerpted from a Rolling Stone of December 6, 2001. 3 years after Linda's death, Paul bounced back as a youthful workaholic elder statesman, with a new fiancé, new album, and harsh words for Yoko Ono. Paul McCartney strolls along Manhattan's Sixth Avenue on a spectacular fall day, leaving a trail of stunned people in his wake. Some just stop dead in their tracks and stare. Others call out to him, "Hey, Paul," or shake his hand. Paul McCartney has a good word or thumbs up for everyone. He's weaving that old Beatles magic, and he knows it. He also knows that New York needs it. He watched the Twin Towers burn on September 11th while seated in an airplane on the tarmac at Kennedy Airport with his fiancée, Heather Mills. The plane never left the ground. Instead, McCartney and Mills retreated to their house on Long Island and continued to watch the devastation on TV. About a week after the attack, the couple quietly visited Ground Zero. We took a cab to Canal Street and went up to the police lines. We asked, could we go down there? A few of the guys recognized me and said, well, you can come through, Paul. It was that kind of spirit, he continues. It was like, good, you're down here. And I was like, it's great what you're doing. The nearer we got, the smoke was in our clothes, in our eyes. We just stood there, said a little prayer. Then we went to this bar nearby. I said, I need a stiff drink. McCartney became determined to help revive the city. Most prominently, he headlined and helped organize the Concert for New York City, which raised more than $30 million for relief efforts. Perhaps just as important, he was a continual, visible, inspiring presence in the city, including at Yankee Stadium, where he could be seen drinking Budweisers, cheering for the Yankees, and leaping up to sing along with the chorus of I Saw Her Standing There, which blared over the PA in his honor. That was only my second time at Yankee Stadium, he mentions, though I've been to Shea Stadium a couple of times. All that activity capped what has been a stellar year, even by the standards of a former Beatle. The Beatles' collection, One, went to number one in 34 countries. Then the double CD Wings compilation, Wingspan, not only fared well commercially, but served an important emotional purpose. It was therapeutic, McCartney says, seeing Linda in Wings. I know she wanted a record of that. Once you do that, you have a form of closure on it. He published a collection of his poems and lyrics called Blackbird Singing. And finally, he has also just released Driving Rain, his first album of new songs in 4 years. And does anyone not know that he got engaged? You've had an amazing burst of energy this year. Paul, well, it all goes back to losing Linda in 1998. When that happened, obviously, my world collapsed. We'd been fighting a battle with Linda's breast cancer for about a year and a half, and in the end, we lost the battle. It was just staggering. Linda and I had been together for 30 years, 4 kids. It was shocking. I thought, how the hell do I deal with this? For about a year, I found myself, anyone who came over, the minute we talked about Linda, I'd say, I'm sorry about this, I've got to cry. I ended up doing Run Devil Run, the rock and roll album, because Linda had wanted me to do it. That was a good jumping off point. You also did some work on her solo record. Paul, that's right. Anything that was Linda related, I could just about cope with. Then, once the sessions had gone around once, I started to notice a lightening of my mood. I was coming out of my shell a little bit because I thought that I was going to be like a monk. Then I met Heather, and I noticed that I liked the way she looked. I said, wait a minute, you're looking at other women. Immediately it was like, uh-oh, you can't do that. The married guilt. I beat myself up a bit about that. But I referred it to Linda, and I started to get the message it was okay, that she wouldn't mind. She communicated with you? Paul, there were strange metaphysical occurrences that seemed to mean something. Animal noises, bird noises. You'd ask yourself a question under the stars, and there'd be like an owl in the valley going, hoo, hoo, hoo. So I started going out with Heather, started having a laugh, feeling good. Oh my God, am I dating? I haven't done this for 30 years. Can I do it? And it was, yes, you can. I started to fall for Heather. That reawakening brought back a lot of energy. I started to write quite a bit more, and I thought, ah, I'll make a new album. With all the success you've enjoyed, what are your hopes for this new album? Paul, I'd like it to have the same effect on people as it has on me. It seems quite positive. And, for that reason, very appropriate for the times? Paul, I've approached records in millions of ways. This one was approached in a very offhand way, and I don't mean in a bad sense. I believe in that approach, in light. Painter Franz Klein said, don't make so much of it. I always like that. On another subject, there was a panic this year when a tabloid newspaper fabricated a quote from George Martin that George Harrison was about to die. Paul, I spoke to George immediately after that. He said, I suppose you're ringing about the newspaper reports. I said, not really, but I'm concerned. He said, I just got an email from George Martin who said, I promise you, George, I really didn't say that. I wouldn't ever. I don't really like to talk about George's health because I don't know enough about it. I don't really like to prod. He's had problems, and I'm not sure of the current stage of things, but every time I ring him, he's very upbeat. So I just cross my fingers and pray things will be all right. The Beatles One collection was one of this year's biggest records, since, unlike George and John, you never went through a phase of disparaging the Beatles. Do you see this kind of success as something of a validation? Paul, that's why I always loved this group? Yeah, that's probably true. I was thinking the other day about the achievements people want in life. It was sort of shocking as I started to think of some of mine. Let's say, imagine being the guy who wrote with John Lennon. Let's just go over this again. The guy that wrote with John Lennon. I have such an admiration for John, but to be the guy who wrote with him? Well, that's enough. Right there, you could retire and go, Jesus, I had a fantastic life. Take me, Lord. It seemed that after John died, people felt that part of praising him meant putting you down. Paul, the minute John died, there started to be a revisionism. There were some strange quotes like, John was the only one in the Beatles, or Paul just booked the studio. John was Mozart. Paul was Salieri. I tried to ignore it, but it built into an insecurity. People would say, Paul, people know. I said, yeah, but what about 50 years in the future? If this revisionism gets around, a lot of kids will be like, did he have a group before Wings? It was only after we'd stopped working together it even reared its ugly head, the whole idea of who wrote what. You remember the story of John getting pissed because he went into a restaurant and the pianist played Yesterday? John once said to me, I wonder how I'll be remembered. I was kind of shocked. I said, I'll tell you how you'll be remembered. You're great, but you won't be there. It won't matter to you, so don't worry about it. And I thought, why'd he get into that? But now I understand. What can you do about it? Paul, I apologize in advance for this. This is a crazy pet peeve of mine. I'll try and keep it short. Lennon-McCartney was always cool. I like it. It's a logo. But what was happening was, for example, my poem, Blackbird, appeared in an anthology as by John Lennon and Paul McCartney. Wait a minute. I wrote that. Sort of like Yesterday, which none of the other Beatles even performed in. Paul, same thing. But this was being reproduced as a poem. I thought, that should really say, written by Paul McCartney, or at the very worst, written by Paul McCartney and John Lennon. So when the Beatles anthology came out after 30 years of always having John's name in front, I thought it should say, Yesterday, by Paul McCartney and John Lennon. So I rang up and asked Yoko. This is when Linda and I were going through real horror times. I rang Yoko and said, couldn't I, on the anthology, just on this one song, put my name in front? Could we put written by Paul McCartney and John Lennon? It would be a great favor. Linda actually rang her and said, do this as a favor. Well, it became a major issue. And listen to me talking about it like I'm trying to make it little. But in the end, she said no. Then, after that, I was in Rome late at night in a bar. And there was a pianist's fake book sitting in the corner. Well, I have to go and look at it, don't I? I open the page and it says, Hey Jude, written by John Lennon. There was no room on the page and Paul McCartney got left off. That was the killer blow. It was like, ah! So I thought to myself, this is what's going to happen. This is what I meant when people said, don't worry, Paul. So I say, put me first, man, but listen, I'm in deep therapy. I'm seeing a therapist every 3 hours about this. He laughs. No, seriously. I do think it would be not a bad thing for me to be allowed to do that, and only when our names are used in full. When it's Lennon-McCartney, John should always come first. How would that ever happen? Paul. Yoko has to say, "What a good idea, Paul." That's unlikely. Paul. It's slightly unlikely, and he laughs. But this is why we don't have a great relationship. That and the fact that Linda rang personally during the height of her chemo shit and asked her, and Yoko said, "That's never going to happen." I don't have a hard time with her. She's a good lady. She's a great artist. I should get off it. There are more important things in the world. But it's become sour, and it never was when John and I worked together. We were the guys who knew it didn't matter. So that's enough gossip for one day, loves. You said you might tour. What else is coming up for you? Paul. I'm getting married. You've set a date? Paul. Well, we did, but we didn't tell a date. He laughs. We just said to people, sometime next year. You know, my nephew's wedding was a week after the bombing, which actually worked out fine because people wanted a release. You had to do the In These Difficult Times speech, but after that, everyone was, let's try and enjoy ourselves, which is one of my big philosophies. When the Beatles were with the Maharishi, he gave us a book. He wrote in mine, Radiate Bliss Consciousness, and then he just put, Enjoy. I took that to heart. If at the end of each day, or most days, you could say, that was a good one, it builds into a reasonably successful life. So I try and enjoy, even when things are looking grim. If you can, try and enjoy it, because it's moving by fast. And in the meantime, he laughs, listen to my record. Our next and quite lengthy article is Paul's Fresh Start by Brian Hyatt, excerpted from Rolling Stone of March 1, 2012. Blowout shows, sessions at Abbey Road, and new songs for breakfast. A glimpse inside the life of a legend as he prepared to turn 70. On his way to work this morning, Paul McCartney had to wait for some pedestrians at a white-striped crosswalk. They stood in groups, cameras in hand, blocking a tree-lined London street. As McCartney sat patiently in his SUV, none of them looked his way, the tourists were too busy taking pictures of themselves crossing Abbey Road. It's happened to me a few times, McCartney says later with a small laugh. It's a moment I quite enjoy. There's a good, strong metaphor there. But there's so many metaphors in my life. I don't look for them. The life of a Beatle is full of metaphors. Resisting an urge to jump out of the car and pose with his fans, he heads straight into hallowed, if distinctly musty-smelling ground, Abbey Road Studio 2. Welcome to my world, he says, striding through double doors at the back of a high-ceilinged, rectangular, gymnasium-like room. He's chomping on a piece of gum. Ancient and modern, every time I come in here, I unravel the whole story again. This is where it all happened. The Beatles recorded most of their music in this unglamorous, white-walled basement space, and passed their initial EMI audition here almost exactly 50 years ago. Aside from some newish acoustic baffles and a different clock, it's hardly changed. In one corner, McCartney yelled, 1, 2, 3, 4, to start, I saw her standing there. In another, he slammed an E major chord on one of the many pianos heard at the end of A Day in the Life. Right now, for no particular reason, he's playing drums. Within moments of his arrival, McCartney dashes over to his kit. He grabs a pair of sticks and crashes through a few bars of a fast beat, heavy on the hi-hat. It sounds distinctly Beatle-ish, or at least Wingsy. McCartney points up at the corner staircase, which leads to the control room where George Martin and the engineers work. That was where the grown-ups lived, he says. Those stairs were so iconic, it's engraved in your memory like a dream. It's a windy late January day. But in keeping with his eternal boyishness, the 69-year-old isn't wearing a jacket, just a black North Face vest over a pressed denim button front shirt that's neatly tucked into his dark jeans, possibly also ironed. On his feet are black running shoes with a white trim. If a hard day's night mob scene should break out, he's ready to move. His ever-fab hair is more tousled than usual, and he looks a little pale today. He's been working too hard. "This has so many memories for me you couldn't imagine," McCartney says. "It's unbelievable." He points to the back corner. John standing over there, doing Girl. He sings the hook, imitating John's sharp intake of breath and miming a deep puff on a joint. People thought it was that. It wasn't. We just liked the sibilance of the sound. All the legendary stories that got created aren't true. I just saw some Beatles program the other night. In the first 5 minutes, there were 4 mistakes. This is why we don't know who Shakespeare was or what really happened at the Battle of Hastings. As the crosswalk incident suggests, a mythic four-headed shadow sometimes threatens to obscure Paul McCartney, actual living human, newlywed, near billionaire, strict vegetarian, father of an 8-year-old girl and 4 adult children, ageless performer of 3-hour rock shows, frenetically active songwriter and recording artist, composer of ballets and symphonies, knight of the realm. With his new album, Kisses on the Bottom, McCartney is adding crooner of standards to that list. It's a jazzy collection of pre-rock tunes, with a couple of McCartney originals in that style sneaked in. He had delayed the Standards album for years, in part because other people, from Ringo Starr in 1970 to Harry Nilsson in 1973, to Rod Stewart for what feels like the past 1,000 years, kept doing it. He also was hesitant to reinforce the once prevalent image of him as a mere sentimental balladeer, the supposed flip side to John Lennon's raw rocker. "I'm over it," McCartney says. "If people don't know the other side of me now, it's too late." Still, Kisses is a one-off. A week before the album's release, McCartney is already working on a new rock record. So far, he's been playing all the instruments himself, the bass, guitars, keyboards and drum kit set up in Studio 2 are all his. "The plan was to do what I'm doing now, which is to almost immediately start into another studio album, so people don't think that that's it. I'm now in the jazz genre." Today, he's recording a song for that next album called Hosanna, an acoustic ballad that wouldn't be out of place on his first solo LP, 1970's McCartney, another one where he played everything. As he puts headphones on and gets down to work, summoning that trumpet-like tone from his familiar old violin-shaped Hofner bass, pounding his foot to the beat, it's almost hard to hear him with all the ghosts hanging in the air. But McCartney doesn't see it that way. He likes working here, and he wears the past as lightly as he can. "As far as things hanging over it, that's something you live with," he says. "I live with that. When I write a song, I have my other songs hanging over it. I suppose the minute you write a decent song, that's a curse. You're always like, oh, shit, I've just written Eleanor Rigby. How am I going to top that?" I think you go, "I'm not." You just realize you're not going to top it. But you write Blackbird. You go in another direction or whatever if you're lucky. I've always been aware of that phenomenon, but I've never let it block me. McCartney is sufficiently self-aware to grasp another irony. Unlike other pop and rock artists who've recorded standard albums, he was responsible for knocking the Great American Songbook off its shelf in the first place, with help, of course, from Lennon and Bob Dylan. "We noticed it happening," he says. "We would see people we had admired saying, oh, the Beatles have ruined it for us. And we didn't mean to do that. We were just getting on with our own thing. We didn't want to lay waste to the past, but it happened that way, so that people like Harold Arlen, who we greatly admired for writing songs like Somewhere Over the Rainbow, fell out of fashion as we came into fashion. And there was no longer such a desperate call for great writers like Lieber and Stoller, because people were starting to copy us and write their own stuff. So the Hollies and the Stones would then start writing, thinking, this is kind of a cool idea. So yeah, it did start a fashion, which tended to wipe out, regrettably, some of our favorite people." It's the day after his recording session and McCartney is back in Studio 2, sitting on a folding chair at a small wooden table, right between the vintage keyboards he's brought in. He's eating a bagel topped with a mix of hummus and the salty British condiment Marmite, periodically exercising what must be a nightly privilege to talk with his mouth completely full. He insists I try some of the hummus. It's the best in the world, very creamy, scraping a bit onto a corner of his plate. Dip your finger in that and try it. Come on. I comply, noticing my finger shaking slightly on its way. Beetle hummus. McCartney's been thinking lately about pre-rock standards' heavy influence on the Beatles' songwriting. He and Lennon were already in their teens before they first heard Elvis Presley, Little Richard, Chuck Berry, and Buddy Holly. We grew up watching Fred Astaire films, and then it was kind of swept aside by rock and roll, he says, biting his bagel. But we still have that influence. The Rolling Stones were influenced by the blues, and we were influenced by rock and roll, blues to some extent, but also, without knowing it, the melodic element of the Beatles and some of the structural elements came from the backs of our brains, which was this old stuff that our parents had sung. McCartney's father, Jim, was a jazz trumpeter who had a band in the 20s. He was also an amateur pianist, and some of Paul's earliest musical memories are of lying on the floor by his piano, listening to his father play the kind of songs Paul sings on his new album. "There's no recordings of my dad," he said, "but my soul's camera has got it. I think he was very good, but he wouldn't have thought he was good enough to be a professional. The people who hired his band obviously didn't think they were very good, because he had to keep changing its name to get another gig. Later, his dad would lobby to have the Beatles cover Gershwin's I'll Build a Stairway to Paradise. Instead, they did songs like Your Mother Should Know and When I'm 64. Granny music, Lennon would call it, though McCartney is quick to note that John liked the old songs, too. McCartney recorded Kisses on the Bottom with a veteran standards and jazz producer, Tony LaPuma, who brought in pianist Diana Krall as musical director. McCartney already knew and liked her. He had attended her wedding to his old collaborator Elvis Costello at Elton's house. They mostly worked in Los Angeles's Capitol Studios, where McCartney sang through a microphone used by Frank Sinatra and Nat King Cole, and in New York, where McCartney insisted on going to the studio on the day Hurricane Irene was supposed to hit. "What's missing in a lot of people who interpret this music," says Krall, "is that they just think, hey, we're just singing standards, babe, and it's not that. It's heavier than that. Paul finds his own story in it." One of the McCartney originals, My Valentine, was written for Nancy Shevel, the glamorous 51-year-old American businesswoman he married last October. The first line, "What if it rained, we didn't care," comes from something she said on a Moroccan vacation. McCartney ran over to an old piano in their hotel, where the song came out almost at once. After two very public marriages, McCartney is reluctant to talk about the third, but he admits it has brightened his outlook. "It has, yeah," he says with a slow nod. "I believe in love. The Beatles sang about it. I've sung about it. Everyone else sings about it. Probably you and your wife believe in it. It's a pretty popular idea, this thing. So now to find love after a divorce is great. It's very refreshing. And Nancy's great. She's intriguing, interesting, lovely, smart, emotional, and all the things you want in a mate. She's absolutely beautiful. She's funny, she's canny, she's great. It's all there." Shevel's reaction to McCartney's latest silly love song was understated. "She's a little shy, so she just dimples shyly," he said. "But I know she likes it. She didn't go crazy. Listen to this. It's a song he just wrote for me. But I know she appreciates." Up in Studio 2's control room, the most melodic songwriter of his generation is making some seriously horrifying noise. McCartney is twisting knobs on an ancient tape machine, messing with a loop of a guitar lick he just played. He speeds it up until it becomes a Beyond Yoko shriek, slows it down until it sounds like droning sludge. He punches stop and smiles. "We do have fun, don't we?" He's working with producer Ethan Johns, the tall, bearded son of producer-engineer Glyn Johns, who worked on Let It Be, on potential tape loop overdubs for Hosanna. In the corner is a Pro Tools setup. though John's is also recording on an analog tape. "Is that enough?" McCartney says after a few more licks. "I could go all day." He puts down his 57 Les Paul. "There was a time when I just had one," he says when John's admires it. "Changed me own strings," and picks up a microphone. He loops some reverby whoos that sound like a ghostly Little Richard, then brings John's over to harmonize on some ahs and ums. Sped up or slow down, they sound like trippy nightmare. McCartney laughs as he heads down the staircase, ready to overdub some bass. All that and no drugs involved. McCartney says he's quit pot altogether after many years and many inconvenient busts, most notably in Japan when he famously ended up in jail for 9 days. "I did a lot, and it was enough," he says. "I smoked my share." When you're bringing up a youngster, your sense of responsibility does kick in, if you're lucky at some point. Enough's enough. You just don't seem to think it's necessary. Did he expect it to be legal by now? "Well, I certainly requested it a bunch of times," he says. "I don't know. It's such a difficult argument. I feel like I've done my bit, and yeah, I'm a bit surprised that it's not legalized. You know the argument that if booze is legal, why not that? And then the argument against it is that we don't need another legal drug. But the argument against that is that you've already got it, so don't pretend you haven't. I'm not going to be the judge of how to deal with it. Somebody else can figure that out." McCartney's lavatory reading these days is Keith Richards' life. He hasn't gotten to the part about himself yet, and the book hasn't succeeded in persuading him to write a memoir of his own, though he did participate extensively in Barry Miles' authorized 1997 biography. "I've got really too much going on to sit around and write stuff about my past, so all of that ends up with me going, I can't be bothered." He confirms that he and Richards struck up a belated friendship a couple of years back and batted around ideas for collaborations that will most likely never come to be. "We had some really funny ideas, and I kept saying, you know, Keith, this is a dangerously good idea. This is ridiculous, bordering on the brilliant." McCartney doesn't share Richards' self-image as a rock and roll outlaw. Unlike Lennon, McCartney never mailed back his Member of the British Empire medal in protest of anything, and he happily accepted a knighthood in 1997. Richards was incensed when Mick Jagger received the same honor. "As a guy in a rock and roll band, you ask yourself, is this cool to do?" McCartney said. "But I saw all sorts of working-class guys who were proud to be honored by the Queen. That was more impressive than the super cool dudes who said, 'No way, man.' I see their argument, but it seemed to me that it's a pretty cool prize to be given by a pretty cool lady." He's still convinced that Her Majesty is a pretty nice girl and will perform at her Diamond Jubilee concert, marking 60 years on the throne, in June. "You have to see it from the perspective of kids who grew up with her coming to the throne," he says. "I remember being on a bus in Liverpool and hearing some kid yelling, 'The king is dead,' like in a movie. Suddenly, it was this Princess Elizabeth, who we always saw as a bit of a babe. We were the right age, and we were quite impressed by her bust. Then when we met her, it was like, 'She's okay. She's cool.' I've always admired the way she's handled this massive job she's got." I see the argument of Annie Monarchus because it's an amazingly old-fashioned affair. But I say to people, who are we going to have to lead our country in the big celebrations opening the Olympics? David Cameron? Tony Blair? I'm not sure about that. 20 years ago, when McCartney turned 50, he remembers his then-manager pushing the idea of retirement. "It's only right," he was told. "You really don't want to go beyond 50. It's going to get embarrassing." In June, McCartney will be 70. "I'm never going to believe I'm 70. I don't care what you say," he says. "There's a little cell in my brain that's never going to believe that." And he still has no plans to stop touring or recording. You get the argument, make way for the young kids, he says. And you think, fuck that. Let them make their own way for themselves. If they're better than me, they'll beat me. Foo Fighters don't have a problem. They're good. They'll do their thing. If you're enjoying it, why do something else? And what would you do? Well, a good answer is, take more holidays. But I don't seem to do that. I love what I do so much that I don't really want to stop. I'm just kind of casually keeping an eye on how I feel, and on stage, it feels like it's always felt. So for the time being, the band's hot. I'm really enjoying myself, still singing like I sang, not experiencing, touch wood, any sort of problems to speak of. If it ain't broke, don't fix it. This morning, downstairs in his studio, Paul McCartney sat down and wrote a new song. It's what he does. Whether he's newly divorced or newly married, happy or sad, the music arrives. I had some thoughts last night. I woke up this morning and took my daughter to school. I was thinking in the car coming back. I put the words together and I just did the melody while you were waiting in the kitchen. He's working with Mark Ronson today, one of several producers he's considering for the record. So he decided to write something appropriate. Mark DJ'd at our wedding reception. So I'm thinking, party. I came up with a song, The Life of a Party Girl. If anything, songs come too easily to McCartney, which may explain how the Beatles-level songs in his solo catalog can coexist with throwaways like Let 'Em In. I have to be careful that something just doesn't come out too bland, he says. Paul Simon works his music much more than I do, with a first draft, a second draft, third draft. I do that as well, but not as much as he does. It's different kind of music. I'm not sure that Arthur Big Boy Crudup thought too much about, that's all right, Mama. Allen Ginsberg used to say, first thought, best thought, and then he'd spend hours editing his work. I do sometimes write one and look at it and shudder and say, I don't like that. At the deepest level, McCartney has little idea where all the melodies come from. He still hasn't figured out how he wrote Yesterday in his sleep. I don't like to use the word magic unless you spell it with a K on the end, because it sounds a bit corny. But when your biggest song, which 3,000 people and counting have recorded, was something which you dreamt, it's very hard to resist the thought that there is something otherworldly there. Does he feel like God sent him a giant check? Or I unwittingly sent it to myself, he says. I have this sort of theory that all the time you're inputting your computer with information from the world, and one day it prints it out for you. I think in the case of Yesterday, it was an involuntary printout. On the other hand, it might be, God, I'm not ruling that out. McCartney always seemed to be the least spiritually inclined Beatle. Or the second least. Who knows what's going on with Ringo? There's no My Sweet Lord in his repertoire, not even And Across the Universe. I believe in a spirit, that's the best I can put it, he says. I think there is something greater than us, and I love it, and I'm grateful to it. But just like everyone else on the planet, I can't pin it down. I'm happy not pinning it down. I pick bits out of all the religions. So I like many things that Buddhists say. I like a lot of things that Jesus said and that Muhammad said. And in the end, McCartney is convinced it all boils down to a very brief message, which he reveals with great Liverpudlian gravity. Be cool and you'll be all right, he says. That's rock and roll religion. This concludes today's recording. I had to omit a few paragraphs within the final article to stay within our time constraints. This has been Dan Klingler, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. Wanna see our pictures on the cover? Wanna buy 5 copies for us?